Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. This week, we will feature segments only from the special post-election panel hosted at the Linda. There were two panels, one from 9 to 10:30 and 10:30 to noon. Each panel had two different sets of panelists. We will hear from both in this hour. On Wednesday, November 6th, Joe was joined by Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post, and Wall Street Investment Banker, Mark Whitman.
Let's get started with this group as we discuss Donald Trump being elected president to be the 47th president of the United States. As it stands now, the Electoral College is 277 to 224. There still are questions out there, but as far as having enough votes to secure the White House, Donald Trump has accomplished that feat. Let me introduce the group to you. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe.
Great to have you here. Also,
thank you.
We welcome, you can clap for Bob, but then you'll have to do it for everybody else. Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow of the Bard College, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Hello, Jim.
Hello, good morning.
Judy Patrick is here, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Hello, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Political consultant, lobbyist, and sparring partner, Libby Post.
Good morning, everyone.
Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson is here. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
And Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman is here.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being a part of this. It's historic by any stretch. You look at what where we are right now of someone, a candidate, Donald Trump, who overcame so much of what I can't imagine another candidate going the events of the last 4 years, and then to be reelected president of the United States, to return to the White House, and as the New York Times headline this morning says, Trump storms back. So we'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the campaign that was run by Kamala Harris. I think it's important that we just set this this tone rather early, is that we're looking to talk this morning about where we go from here and what we should make of this in the most positive light as we possibly can. I also think that it's important to realize that this was, and if anyone on the panel would like to disagree with me, but this was a good old-fashioned drubbing. I mean, this was a very, very, this was not a close election. This was an election that was very clear. And one thing we will not hear today, I'm guessing, is anything about issues with voting machines or fraudulent votes or any of that. We probably won't be hearing that throughout the rest of this week. Let me get to the group and have sort of opening statements on just your thoughts of what happened last night, and as we looked at the end, finally, of this very, very long campaign. Let us begin with Bob Griffin.
Thanks, Joe. What I'm going to try to do, Joe, is I'll wallow in sort of self-pity for a little bit, but the reality is the worst thing we can do is just give up. I was on the radio last week, and I predicted that Harris was going to win by a larger margin than was polling, and obviously I was absolutely dead wrong. I'm still surprised at some of the votes coming out. I felt like things were starting to wobble when some of the exit interview numbers were coming out, when huge portions of the population said that they'd already made up their mind in September, which meant that a lot of the messaging that I think Harris was able to do, or a lot of the gaffes that we saw towards the end of the election were able to kick in. So I would tell you, though, I did not expect every swing state to go to Trump.
All seven.
I also think that, you know, a couple issues that I'll toss out and we can talk about. One is, and I'm going to end on a positive note, one is the way the campaign was run by, you know, particularly by Trump, which I sort of categorized as sort of almost a frat boy campaign. And I think collectively we and society have to have a real conversation about gender roles and where the country is. I think it's a really important conversation. I would say it's a good time to be in New York, and for all of the issues that people want to say about New York, you know, it's nice to be in a place that voted to protect, not only protect, but truly incorporate civil liberties and civil rights into our framing legal documents. But it's also a message, and I say this to the crowd and anybody who's listening, this is also why state and particularly local elections are so important. And we need to come back to that, because this is how we deal with some of the craziness that we're going to see coming out of the federal government in the next 4 years. Is that we act locally and we start to rebuild, and we start to think about what a coalition could and should be.
Jim?
Segueing from that focus on state and localities, I just want to, this is something I think is positive about yesterday, and that is that I've worked on elections around the world, and I've seen up close countries that struggle with just even holding elections. And so, irrespective of the outcome, just the fact that we were able to put on, between early voting and then all that happened yesterday, an election that takes place on a national level but is really implemented by localities and is really implemented by citizens who go out and administer it and make it happen. And that, you know, that our election systems have been under siege politically. They have been yesterday with bomb threats and other kinds of interference. That really, I think, in general, you know, people came out, people who run these elections, officials on the local level and the citizens who administer them, polling station by polling station, came out and did the work that is necessary to make that happen, and demonstrates that there is that capacity to do things and to do them right and to do them well. And so I speak from some experience because, as I said, I've been working around the world on elections, and this year I've also taken some time out to work at the polls here in the U.S., and I worked the polls yesterday. And I'm just so impressed with my fellow citizens who were there working the polls. You know, you have to get there 5:30, even earlier. You have to set everything up. It's no easy task. And then you're there until 9, and then you take everything down, and you have to do it in a way that maintains the freeness and fairness of these elections in that polling station. And there were lots of people coming in. It was as busy as I've ever seen, and there were times when this group of people, 9 people who don't know each other, were working very, very well as a team. And so I take that away as a great positive. It's not a minor thing because, as Bob was saying, you know, we're going to have to counter things on the state and local level. And it's not just about policy. It's not, I mean, policy in meaning conjuring up ideas. But policy has to be matched up with capacity to actually do things, to implement things. And I think this has been one of the things that really has been lost in the United States in the last few years, and it's one of the things that has undermined a sense of legitimacy about our institutions, is that they've been unable to actually accomplish things, big things and small things. And it's often the small things, the daily things, the things you're not really paying attention to that really matter. So my takeaway from yesterday, you know, we're going to have plenty of time to talk about the macro level politics, but on the micro level and the administrative stuff that makes things work, it was positive. It was very positive.
Judy Patrick.
Sexism and racism definitely were involved. I agree. But I think it's time for the Democrats, or some tough time for some tough talk for the Democrats. I think that clearly their message, it does not resonate with the American voters. This was an election about the economy, and you can talk as much as you want about the price index going up or down and unemployment going up or down, but if bread costs $5 at the grocery store, you're going to lose people. Democrats too often are condescending, sanctimonious to people, and that has had significant blowback, and it you can see it. This was not a close election, despite the weeks of news stories about how razor thin this election was going to be. This was not close. We need to recognize that. And can I, on a positive note, I have a 7-year-old grandson who was glued to CNN last night and told his mother that this was the most important election of his lifetime at seven. And so this is, you know, this was early in the evening, and I was concerned because, you know, the election could have gone either way. So I had to have a talk with him, and I said, you know, this is how democracy works. Sometimes the person you want to win will win, and sometimes they will lose, but there is always another election, and so you need to focus on that. What I am concerned about this morning is that people whose candidate lost will become disillusioned and withdraw from the political process. That's not what we need at this point.
Was your grandson at least happy that his grandfather won?
I haven't heard about that, but what I haven't heard about.
Judy's husband ran for town justice in Greenwich, yes, and won last night. So
yes.
Very good. Libby Post.
Well, I remember we were all sitting here, if you were here, 8 years ago when Trump won, and everybody was totally shell-shocked, and I said then what I'm going to say now is that we can't give up. We have to keep working. Yes, the Democrats can be a little pedantic. I think more than snotty, we tend to think people are going to actually respond to facts, and that's just wrong. And, you know, it's about emotions and values. And that's how people win. And it's love, hate, fear, and hope. And you know, Trump has the market on fear and hate. And the value issues that his voters hold dear, which is the value of racism. I've said this on the air, and people have taken umbrage at it. He hates the same people his voters hate. And so they really are motivated by that. And this was about race, it was about misogyny, it was about homophobia, transphobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-immigrant, all of that stuff. And these are folks that want to be told what to think and how to and what to do. And so that's exactly what he's been very effective in doing. How people can actually follow the train of thought still boggles my mind, but nonetheless, he's been very good at pushing that hate button and having people respond to it. We have to get back to our democratic roots. We have to get back to talking to the working class, because that's where we lost a lot. We've lost the working class. You know, my dad was a union guy, U.S. Postal Service. I walked on that picket line when the postal workers struck in 1968. You know, it was all Dems. It was all, that has been lost, and we have to find our way back to that, and find a way of bringing more people in. You know, I read something this morning, you know, identity politics is killing the Democratic Party, and I think that there has to be a discussion about that, but I can tell you this, that I will always identify as a lesbian and as a woman, and if that's identity politics, then that's the way it goes. But, you know, we've got a bigger tent. They've just got more people who want to make sure that our tent is kept as empty as humanly possible. So Joe Hill said it best, don't mourn, organize. And that's what we have to do. We can't give up.
Sarah Rogerson.
So in the long-term picture, it was really important that, however things turned out today, that they were decisive.
Yeah.
One way or the other, because we are not in a good place as a country right now. That's something we can all agree on. We're not talking to each other, we're not hearing each other. We're falling prey to our own critiques of our own individual party problems.
May I just jump in to say that the exit polls illustrated that on whether people voted Democratic or they voted Republican, that most of the people in the 60-70% range said that the country was moving in the wrong direction.
Correct. So we all agree on something. And so then the problem, then it's, you know, what do we do about it? And we have very different ideas of what to do about it. So we're talking about very different imagined futures because the future hasn't happened yet. We don't know what the full extent of these results mean for ourselves and for people that we care about or don't care about but pay attention to. I was much like Judy's grandson at the age of 7, 8, 9, 10, begging my parents to stay up to watch Ronald Reagan give the State of the Union address because it was important and it mattered. And I knew from a very young age that what our government did mattered to me, a little girl in the rural Midwest. And I think it's important for Democrats to get back to working class roots, but also just to a vision of the country that actually includes everyone. It is stunning that there were ballot initiatives in progressive states that where voters voted against increasing the minimum wage, against allowing tips on top of minimum wage. We have blue states, we have people voting blue that are not supporting working class values. We have people in red states who are passing abortion protections. We need a therapist, a political therapist that is skilled in helping us have a better conversation because the rhetoric is toxic. And I wasn't here the day after the election in 2016 because I was in immigration court for a 9 a.m. hearing with a student for a special immigrant juvenile who had a valid path to a green card with many, many roadblocks that have been intentionally created by statute. And the immigration judge after the hearing gave us like a really hard time. It was kind of unexpected. And so I kind of gave it right back to him when we were off the record. And I said, do you understand, do you even have any empathy for what today is? And he looked at me and he said, what did you think was gonna happen? And I was real mad about it for a while, listening to Hillary Clinton's concession speech on the way back to the law school to sit with my tenure committee to decide whether or not I had a job. So that was a big day, but not one I'll forget anytime soon. But I really appreciated the comment, if not the commenter, because it got me to focus strategically on where I put my efforts and where it backs up my values. And it's not always on the Democratic ticket, but it is always in serious conversation with people that disagree with me. And if you didn't do it back then, it's time to start doing it now. You need to sit down with people who disagree with you and not just talk at them or judge them, but listen to them on both sides. I'm tired of being called names. I'm tired of saying I'm disillusioned or pie in the sky. I similarly pledge to Americans who voted for Trump, I will not call you names. It's not helpful, but we need an intervention, and it's not Donald Trump, but it might be the truth that Republican voters have to face in terms of what they chose. to be ruled by. Good luck with that.
Good stuff. Mark.
We're okay on time, Joe?
Yeah.
I just want
yeah.
to. So, believe it or not, when I woke up this
4 years.
Yeah.
At least.
So I intentionally yesterday shut off all news media, went to bed early. I figured there'd be plenty of time to sort through all this. I opened up my news apps this morning at about 6. And the first thing I thought of, strangely, was Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, which actually was on PBS, if anyone remembers the program.
Oh, yeah.
And in the wake of the carnage of October of 87, I remember him sort of looking into the camera and assuring his listeners that their dogs still loved them, that their loved ones still loved them, and that they needed to basically continue to be engaged in the world around them. And I'll tell the story briefly, but earlier this week I talked about sort of being reintroduced to Frederick Douglass, a formerly enslaved man who eventually fled the country because even though he was in the North, he was afraid he was going to be captured and re-enslaved. In order to come back to the U.S., he had to technically buy his freedom. But he came back to the U.S. and he continued to work on this project we call democracy, even amidst the carnage, literal carnage, that most of the country was effectively in support of at the time. So I think it's important, and somebody else told this to me in no uncertain terms, to realize what our role always is and needs to be, particularly in times like this. And that it's a real opportunity to look at those who are going to be particularly disadvantaged by this next administration and look at where we can be helpful. I also think our presence here today testifies to the fact that we believe and should continue to believe and support the notion that the continued enlightenment of the citizenry of this country is crucial to its future, right? I mean, it was Benjamin Franklin who said, a republic, if you can keep it, and if you remember one of Benjamin Franklin's projects, particularly later in life, was effectively what we call universal education. So look, what happened? Trump convinced the public that they were economic victims of the Democrats because the Democrats were responsible for inflation, globalism, and immigration. And the Democrats, particularly, frankly, a candidate who was part of the current administration, were unable to convince Americans differently. And when I say Americans, I mean Americans more broadly than you would have thought. If you look at the Bronx, voted for Donald Trump, I think nearly 40% of the Bronx. Wayne County, Detroit, the numbers, the increased support within Detroit for Trump was tremendous. In retrospect, I wonder if Biden's election was the aberration. If COVID and Biden's particular appeal to the working class were the aberration of what we've seen over the last few years. I do believe in Sarah's point that in Joe's point that in the short run, we're going to avoid an imbroglio over the election that might have been terrible. But I don't think we've bought ourselves much time. We have now, this is going to be Trump unleashed. He's not worried about a second term. He's gonna have the Senate, most likely the House, and he's got a judiciary that he's populated with many people. And in addition to that, the Supreme Court and its eraser ripped a hole in the Constitution and in the balance of powers, and we don't yet know how big that hole is. But I think that points to two things. One is there is a natural circuit breaker. There was never a wall built by Mexico during his first term. He's not gonna deport 11 million people who are here illegally. He just practically cannot. His economic programs won't come to pass in full because they are so ill-conceived that the markets and eventually politicians will self-correct. And aside from that, I get back to my first point. There is a role for all of us to continue to perfect this democracy, no matter how badly we feel today.
Yeah. I'm
sorry.
No, I look.
It's okay to have feelings. That's going to be another thing I talk about for the next 4 years because the frat house syndrome is real. This is not empathy, but it's also important for us to talk about our feelings when we're angry, when we feel disaffected, when we feel like we're not being represented. Everyone should feel empowered to do that. That's something that we can all agree on as well.
And that's why we need a political therapist.
Maybe we can bring back Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
Oh, my God. No, you can't.
Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers, yes. That would be good.
Anybody have any comments that they'd like to add before we move on? Bob? Or Jim, go ahead.
So I think there were a couple of key decision points that happened, and we certainly talked about both of them on the roundtable for many episodes. One of them was the decision by Joe Biden himself, and by the Biden administration, for him to say, to dig in his heels and say he was going to run no matter what, and to hold on to that position for far too long. And it was only when his problems were revealed in the debate that it became apparent, really late in the game, that something had to happen. But I would say far too late. And if he had just said that he wasn't going to and the Democratic Party was able to go through the normal process, I think that really would have been a much better process for the party and given it the time to really prepare for what was going to be a very difficult campaign. Secondly, given the way the things really did play out, then there was a decision to anoint Kamala Harris. Now, there were people like James Carville and others who were saying there should have been kind of a lightning mini primary, and that if Kamala Harris had prevailed in that, she would have ended up being much stronger, being battle-tested, having the specifics, and maybe she wouldn't have prevailed. Maybe another candidate would have prevailed who would have had a better chance of winning. So I think these were two important decisions to go back and look at and say, you know, was this really the right thing to do? I think in both cases, it probably wasn't the right thing to do. I do think that she ran a great campaign given the amount of time that she had, but it's just politically, it's never a good idea to be anointed.
That was Jim Ketterer on the roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 6th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, November 6th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, the Ulster County Comptroller and the former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Diplomat in Residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Just go around the down the table here and have you express just your kind of baseline thoughts on the election and what happened last night, and then we'll get into some of the specifics and expand on some of the issues that we talked about in the first half of the program. So let us begin with Malia Dumont.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning, everyone. These are really special events to be here with a live audience. Thanks, all of you, for coming. So I'm here with the Ulster County contingent.
We, yes.
We commuted up together. We're trying to live our values, be sustainable.
So. You are so WAM.
So I didn't share my election prediction with very many people, but last week I did tell a few close friends that I thought Trump was going to win. And they immediately became so upset that I stopped telling people. Fred and I were discussing in the car on the way up here, he also thought Trump was going to win. And there was a gentleman in the audience who spoke before the break about it's the economy, stupid. And I think a lot of it comes back to whether it's real or perceived, like the perceptions of the economy and people's well-being now. And unfortunately, Kamala Harris didn't have a lot to work with from the Biden administration in that sense. I think she ran a terrific campaign, the best possible campaign one could run in these extremely challenging circumstances, to be thrust into that role at the last minute to really marshal everyone, get out the vote the way she did. I don't fault her at all. I really think that she threaded the needle the best she could with trying to show her leadership and be positive while not, I mean, it's very hard when, you know, she's still working for her boss who's still the president. And so I think that was, that ended up being too difficult a hole for her to come out of. Unfortunately, but I think that hopefully we'll talk more about this during the panel. But what I want to propose, my analysis, I'm not here to try to make anyone feel better, unfortunately. I'm here to provide my analysis of the situation. And my analysis is that Democrats really have a crisis of identity that they have not truly faced because Trump is so reprehensible as a person. That has enabled a lot of people to focus on his character, which is certainly worth complaining about. But in terms of connecting with voters across the country, that's not the best way to do it. And I think the results show that the Democrat Party is not really connecting with a lot of voters in this country, that Republican districts became more Republican. Few local bright spots. March and I were at the Ulster County Dems event last night. We saw Pat Ryan win his race. We saw Josh Riley win his race for the House. And I think that those are two examples of Democrats really focusing in a positive way locally and distancing themselves effectively from the Biden administration, which would have been, if Biden had been the nominee, had remained the nominee, isn't like those two probably wouldn't have won. And I'll just add really quickly, you can get involved locally without having to run for office. Libby had some great suggestions before, but for example, I'm on the Conservation Action Council, I think, for the city of Kingston. There are a lot of boards and things you don't have to run for. There are always vacancies. So whatever you're interested in, I'm sure your town or your county has some kind of way for you to get involved.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I look back at this election, and everybody is looking to, if they don't like the outcome, to blame it or explain it if they even like the outcome. But I think one of the realities is that we don't teach history enough anymore. We don't teach civics enough in school anymore. And there was one quick, exit poll analysis I heard this morning driving over about young men like 20-something young men who really came out strong in the end and decided to vote for Donald Trump. And, it's the inability to see and put in perspective what's going on today. It's so easy to look back and analyze it after the fact. But I think that we need to encourage that civic engagement. If there's any good news, and there's not a lot for people who are disappointed about the outcome, the good news is that Donald Trump can't run for another term. In a way, he is a lame duck president. He's going to try to do a lot, but And I also urge Democrats who are in any kind of power, if the House does end up becoming Democratic and Akeem Jeffries, a New Yorker, becomes the Speaker of the House, if that does happen, and we apparently won't find out for days or even weeks, that they don't take that approach that Mitch McConnell took when President Obama was elected back in 2008. I can remember Mitch McConnell saying, our job is to make sure President Obama fails. You know, you certainly don't want to, if you're from the Democrat side, you're not going to want to see a lot of policies that Trump has promised and a lot of his actions happen. But I think you have to reach across, and you have to be a big part of reaching for bipartisanship. Republicans in office have demonstrated that they're afraid to publicly oppose Trump. But Republican governors feel a little more freedom to do it or to not pay much attention to it, to kind of look beyond it. Democratic governors and Republican governors have a chance to do a lot together and lobby and pass laws in their own states that protect their residents and promote policies that might be different than what's going on at the national level. I mean, there's a lot that can happen, but people, if it's just going to be four more years of this past election, I think we're making a really big mistake.
When you all contributed, did you think you were also going to get impressions?
Pretty good, Mike. Nicely done. Fred Hoff.
Well, first, thank you all very much for coming this morning. Good morning to everybody. I'll begin. I was not about to mention this, but just to echo something Mike said. One of the things I would have bet on 4 years ago when President Biden first assumed the presidency was that he would at some point come up with a national service initiative for the United States. I mean, one of the lessons learned from January 6th and many events preceding January 6th is that too many Americans, and perhaps we can focus on young white males, are disconnected in any practical sense from the governance of their country. And it strikes me that, it has always struck me, it's something I believed in for decades, that mandatory national service, not just uniformed service in the military, but mandatory national service ought to be a very, very high public policy priority in this country. I think that what we're seeing more than anything else in these election results is a national verdict on the Biden presidency. Vice President Harris was no more able to separate herself from Joe Biden than Hubert Humphrey was able to separate himself from Lyndon Johnson. And I know the prevailing sentiment in this room is that Joe Biden has been a good president. But what Kamala Harris had to overcome was the belief of some 60% of our fellow citizens that the Biden administration failed in two key areas, the economy and securing our southern border. And these were the top two substantive issues in this election. Reproductive rights, as it turns out, was far below these two issues in terms of being of central concern to American voters. It was only the presence of a third issue, the character of Donald Trump, that enabled the vice president to get, as of the current count, some 48% of the vote, and perhaps even closer to 50 when all the ballots from California are counted. Indeed, I know of precisely no one among friends and family who voted for Kamala Harris because they were enthusiastically convinced that she would be a good or great president. They voted for her mainly because her surname is not Trump, and because she was on the right side of issues they considered to be important. But the economy, southern border, and to a lesser but I think important extent, a widespread impression that Trump would be stronger than Harris in terms of foreign policy and national security affairs combined to produce a victory for the ex-president. And I suspect that history will be kind to Joe Biden on several issues, including, ironically, the state of the economy he is bequeathing to Donald Trump. But it will not be at all kind in its assessment of the role he, his family, and his entourage played in producing a victory for the ex-president. And perhaps we can get into that later. Thanks.
Teresa Bourgeois.
So I got an email during the night sometime from a friend saying, what's the heck, and it didn't say heck, is going on with our country. And I wrote back a long answer, and I just want to, I think, share three paragraphs with it about it, because I really am concerned about young people. And I said, it's frightening to realize that so many young people will have only known the Trump era, when honesty and truth and the rule of law and morals and decency just do not matter if you are men of privilege, where the fundamentals of our democracy are not sacrosanct, but treated as mere suggestions to adhere to or not as he wishes, an era in which too many of our leaders in government and business are just enablers and therefore accomplices to behavior that they know is wrong. All of the historic firebreaks have failed, allowing this firestorm of hate and greed and vengeance and chaos to rage on unchecked. I fear that those young people and many of us are in for some very tough times. We will have difficult decisions to make about what to stand up for and what to stand against. The income inequality gap will grow exponentially larger. Those who seek to gain power by creating divisions across the country will be emboldened by this. Those who have gained power have their playbook ready. It's Project 2025. None of that bodes well for the majority of us, nor for our allies in Europe and around the globe. So I think we really have to be concerned about what, you know, sort of what is defined by our democracy now and whether or not we can hold it. And I actually opened this by talking about gender. And so I would, Fred, I would respectfully suggest that gender was a deep, deep issue behind this. And Biden did, in fact, have a strong economy. We'll get to that later. And had a historic legislative record. And much of that Trump has promised to tear apart. And the Green New Deal, the infrastructure bill, healthcare, all of those things that are fundamental to the lives of the people who voted against him. And that, I think, gets into an issue of communications. And where I think the Biden administration did fail is on communicating their successes. But there's something deeper going on here, I think, that we don't have a grasp of, which is the success of the disinformation campaign that we need to be mindful of, which I think we should talk about.
By the way, a very impressive text that you sent back to your friend. I just usually do like a thumbs up emoji. That's a real thoughtful.
It was. I'd like to actually read the whole thing. But it was.
Well, we got to be out by noon.
I know.
So
I read the whole thing. It'll be a great op-ed in the Times Union.
That's what March I do Gallagher. When I can't sleep. But it's. I really am worried about our young people and about what their role, the model is for our democracy.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 6th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. Continuing the panel from Wednesday, November 6, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, the Ulster County Comptroller and the former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Diplomat in Residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Marsh Gallagher.
So I'm going to say a lot of things people don't want to hear,
because okay.
That's what we need to do going forward. First of all, I woke up this morning, sent an extensive text to all my kids. We have a blended family, so stepchildren, regular children, girlfriends, and boyfriends of them. I'm sorry. That's what I said. I take responsibility. I'm a Democratic elected official. I was a party official for years. The Democratic Party has lost its way. And I think the numbers bear that out. You know, Harris did worse than Biden, even in the states that she won. And look, the change to Harris, that was not a grassroots pick. That was the Democratic machine deciding this is what we're going to do. And I don't agree that it was gender. I am really concerned about reproductive freedom, and my position is it's priceless. You cannot put a price on it. I don't care about gas prices compared to the ability of me and my, you know, family going forward to be able to make these choices for ourselves. But at the same time, how can we say it's gender-driven when we all know damn well, excuse me, if Joe Biden was on the ticket, he would have lost. So you cannot say that this is identity politics, that Harris lost because she was a woman of color, because she was a woman, because she was of color. That is not true. If Biden was there, I think it would have been a landslide victory, and we probably would have had the results even earlier in the night. So the Democrats need to rethink what we're doing and what we're saying. We don't champion our own wins well at all. We're not able to talk about our victories. We're focused on little issues that are small groups of people instead of speaking the voice of labor and the working people, family issues, kitchen table issues. It is the economy. I was telling my colleagues in the car on the way up that I made a decision about 10 years ago to shift away from environmental policy. That's my background, if you look me up, to focus on health and human services, because desperate people cannot make good decisions about things like composting and solar panels. We are not focused on the issues that really need to be addressed. So, I'm sorry. I'm issuing a public apology on behalf of the Democratic Committee and Democratic elected leaders. We've blown it. We don't have our messaging right. We don't have our issues right. And we've made a huge blunder here. I agree with Teresa. I am really worried about young people. And the one solace I have is that the next presidential race, they are going to have a lot more people than we do coming, you know, of age to be able to vote. So I'm going to pause there. I have a lot more to say, but I want to get it out there. We've made a huge mistake, and we need to accept responsibility for it. Finger pointing is not it unless we're pointing at ourselves.
We still have two folks to check in with on just opening thoughts. Jim Hendler.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you all for coming. I usually style myself on the show as the data geek. I realize probably data nerd would be the better technical term, but you know, it's a little early in this election to start doing that. So in 2016, the way I consoled myself was I just found every piece of data I can, ran every piece of data analytics to figure out what happened. I'll tell you that an interesting thing about 2016, it was pretty easy to show that Hillary lost as opposed to Trump won. And I mean that in a technical sense that I won't go into. What's interesting in this election, it's already clear that so what I'm really trying to say is Hillary was the issue. Hillary didn't win an election that was winnable. Here, Trump won, right? That's really what I'm saying. In other words, that all the data that traditionally predicts somebody being the winner lines up with Trump being the winner, which was not the case in 16. I think though, that one of the things that really needs to be made clear is this was a close election. This was not a slam dunk. And frankly, that was also true in 2020. 100,000 votes could have changed the election 2020. We don't know yet what that final number will be here. And you know, I think there's a lot of weird things we could get into. You know, somebody was talking about how people voted against minimum wage and things like that, and yet, you know, again, a lot of those things were not what you would predict. So in several of the blue states, those laws lost, but in some of the red states, they won. So in Missouri, a overwhelming majority voted in favor of raising the minimum wage and allowing paid sick leave, right? Missouri was called for Trump the second the polls closed. So again, we're seeing some interesting things. There's one thing I haven't heard today, and I'm not trying to cast blame on anyone, but what's interesting is if you look at the polls, if you look at the polling models, I think there was one huge mistake that was made, which is there's been an assumption that immigrants, particularly people from Latin countries, et cetera, are a Democratic voting bloc. And this year, we saw a 30% swing in that electorate. Just to be clear, that electorate is 20% now of the US electorate. So if you do a little bit of math, that's not, you don't even need like my computer to do this, that's 6% of the vote. And a lot of that vote was in the rural counties where the margin of error was where Kamala was trying to pull the votes away from Trump. We don't know yet what the gender gap there is. My guess is it's going to be as large or larger than the others. But it was pretty clear that a large part of what's happened is there's been a very traditional notion of who are the Democratic voters and who are the Republican voters, and I agree with some of the previous speakers on both panels that the Democrats really need to go back and start looking at that whole thing again and figure out who is the base, where are they, what do we need to do? Overcoming the Electoral College deficit is going to remain hard and harder, but really, I mean, we're talking about changing 3 to 4% of the people in America's opinion, makes the difference of who's the president. And that's something where some pretty serious thinking has to go in.
All right, Heather.
So last week, I think, when I was on the radio, I said I'd been talking to heads of chambers, because the Business Council is the state chamber of commerce, not part of the state, it's an association of private businesses, but I've been talking to my peers across the country, and in particular, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania both said last week, like, he's going to win and he's going to win big. And this was not a close election. I actually beg to differ on that. It looks like Trump is on track to win the popular vote as well as the Electoral College. In states that are traditional blue states like New York, he actually outperformed what he did last time. In fact, when he ran against Biden, he lost the state by 23 points, and this time he lost the state by 11 points. And that is true in virtually every blue state in the country, that he gained ground in areas that are blue. But in Albany here, I think we live in a blue bubble, and I think I'm guilty of some wishful thinking, and I also think a lot of pollsters are guilty of some wishful thinking. I mean, my biggest takeaway on this is, A, I always get it wrong, and B, the polling is wrong again. They know what they did wrong last time. They know what they did wrong the time before, and they continue to make the same mistakes. I think probably in part that's because of technology changes that haven't caught up, but it really is pretty telling when I think yesterday, virtually every polling outlet said Harris is surging, she's likely going to win, and not only does she not win, but she loses pretty big. And I agree with March that I think, and I'm not a member of either party, but I do think the Democratic Party needs to do some self-reflection to understand why they really lost the middle that they had been the champion of for so long. And if you just blame misinformation, if you just blame the economy, you're going to miss the point. You need to look at all of the factors. You need to look at what are you advocating for, and does it resonate with the people who are voting, because they're moving away from you. And that is something that I hope will happen. My prediction is with our state legislature, which is where I do most of my work, it will not happen. In fact, I think they'll double down in order to provide a perceived counterbalance to national policies, try and solve at the state level things that can't be solved at the federal level. So I think that is somewhat unfortunate. I think that it will continue to alienate folks in the middle, even here in New York. So those are my somewhat depressing thoughts. Sorry.
So, Joe, can I just respond what I meant by a close election? You know, you mentioned some of these states, right? The ones where we have all the votes in. So in Wisconsin, you're talking 30,000 votes separating them. In Pennsylvania, at the moment, you're talking 15,000,
yep.
Right? So we're talking very small numbers in very large states that were the states that were the swing states. And there's virtually, there's one or two of the swing states, North Carolina, et cetera, where Trump won by fairly large margins compared to what you would have expected.
Yep.
But in some of the states that really could have made a difference, it really was small numbers. And that's where, you know, that's where trying to do an election analysis of the whole country gets very complicated, because, you know, a very small number of voters in one state can make a huge difference.
The very definition of a swing state, which Florida used to be and is no longer. But my view on the whole, I think we've set up a system that is designed to disenfranchise voters in the minority in every state. Because if you do every electoral college vote goes with what the popular vote is in the state, then you have a state like New York where 40% of the people voted for Trump, their vote doesn't count. Not in New York. And same with California. Florida, half the people voted for, not this time, but close to half voted for a Democrat. Their vote doesn't count because we have this all-in casting of the electoral college votes. There are two states that don't do that, and those states are actually protecting the rights of people who vote for the candidate that didn't win the majority in that state. And I think that's a really unfortunate thing. There is absolutely zero chance that that this system will change, because the legislature has to change it. And so in a state like New York, our legislature is solidly blue. They're not going to give over electoral college votes to Republicans. And the reverse is true in Texas and Florida. So it is unfortunate. But the swing state phenomenon is they're always going to be close in the swing states. That is what makes them swing states.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 6th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.